From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Right now, in America, a generation of leaders born in the age of the Great Depression and World War II is fading away. Stepping up is a generation of young leaders raised on peace and plenty, infomercials and internet connections. From different times come different people and different leaders. In this hour, we look at how eras and values shape those who take charge. We begin with the latest developments in the Enron scandal. Former Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fastow surrendered to FBI agents yesterday. The federal government charged him with fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy. New York Times reporter Kurt Eichenwald says the criminal complaint reveals how Enron's bad business decisions paved the way for Enron's bad ethics. I asked what the Fastow complaint reveals about Enron's business practices.
Well, largely that this was a company that has been mismanaged for years. I mean, what is amazing about Enron is it had an incredible reputation for spectacular business acumen. But when you look at what was going on inside the company, they were flinging billions of dollars around the world, picking up assets that nobody else wanted. And when they started when those purchases started crippling their financial performance, they would dump them off into Mr. Fastow's partnerships and make it look like they were doing well. So it really was a financing technique being used to disguise truly bad business decisions.
You describe some of that as having been called nuclear waste by the Enron staff, that is, deals so bad, so ugly, that they were desperate to hide the financial impact of them. Andrew Fastow began looking just greedy, but now he looks like someone desperately trying to clean up behind bad businessmen.
Well, I mean, he's a little bit of both. I mean, one of the things you look at here, not to engage in pop psychology, but Fastow was really the guy who was keeping the trains running. If it wasn't for his partnerships, the reality of what Enron was on a financial level would have emerged much, much earlier. The company would not have had the reputation it did have, and it would have, taken quite a while to work it all out. So ultimately, here's a man who's keeping everything running who isn't getting to partake in the huge bonuses that others are. And so in a way, you kind of wonder, did Andrew Fastow decide to craft his own bonus plan? Now, the reality of it is that what he was doing by keeping these realities hidden was allowing Enron some breathing room, but also removing the incentive to fix the problems.
Mm-hmm. Kurt Eichenwald, give us a couple of examples of the so-called nuclear waste, the terrible deals, the terrible purchases that Andrew Fastow was left to deal with for Enron.
Well, one of them is a project from Cuiabá, Brazil, where they had a power plant there. The power plant was simply a mess from day one. It wasn't functioning properly. They had massive cost overruns.
Why did Enron own it?
I have no idea. I mean, what you're looking at is the consequence of a corporation that was consistently enmeshed in political battles and not focusing on the business. Jeff Skilling, who was eventually was the chairman and chief executive, hated all the assets. He didn't want to have them there, but he was president and COO, and most of them were acquired. Ken Lay, who was the chairman and chief executive, loved the international side. And they expended a lot of money in those areas.
So how did Andrew Fastow deal with the Cuiabá power plant?
Well, Enron wanted it off its books, and they could do so by selling a percentage of it to someone else. No one would buy it. Fastow had a partnership called LJM. Mm-hmm. He bought the Cuiabá percentage stake, but according to the complaint, on the condition that it would be repurchased from LJM, at a profit. That is a securities law no-no. What that means is that there is no real transaction.
But it made Enron's books look good for the quarter they were closing.
That's what the complaint alleges. Yes.
And so the stock market didn't see the kind of lousy business going on, and so Enron's stock did not take a hit.
That's right. I mean, it is truly something magical. I mean, they're turning dross into gold. They're taking bad business decisions and transforming them into profits. And ultimately, when you look at that, you can only go so long juggling the books. You can only go so long using accounting maneuvers to look good The reality is this company simply did not have the operating cash flow to support all of the debt they were taking on in these financial finaglings.
So you raised the question, but you don't answer it, at least didn't this morning. How could a company attain such a tremendous reputation when it was flinging billions of dollars around the globe, buying assets that no one else wanted? Why didn't that filter through in our market system to disrespect for Enron?
Because we're all fools. Because in the late 1990s, it didn't really matter what the realities were of financial performance. No one understood how Enron made its money, but no one cared because Enron was making money and their stock price was going up. And that was what we measured success by. Is it successful? Is it going up? Am I making money? The true imperative of investing is you have to look at something and say, do I understand it? Do I understand how this is making money? And if I do understand how it's making money, when are the good days going to pass? Because they always do. With Enron, nobody understood where the money was coming from. Nobody understood how this entity was creating all these levels of cash flow. And we didn't care because people were getting rich off of Enron, and nobody wanted to really open up the golden goose to figure out what was inside.
And it was ugly in there. Is it fair, Kurt Eichenwald, for Andrew Fastow to be paying the piper now, or is it more than fair?
I wouldn't want to speak as to whether Mr. Fastow is guilty or not. That's certainly not my judgment to make. If he is guilty of the crimes with which he's accused, yes, it is fair. But there's an if there. It still has to be proven in court. Mr. Fastow engaged in transactions, if the complaint is correct, in which he was stealing money from Enron's shareholders. He engaged in transactions that allowed Enron to circumvent regulatory requirements. And more important, he engaged in transactions that disguised the true financial performance of the company. In our world, it doesn't matter if you have external pressure to break the law. It doesn't matter if other people tell you to break the law. We don't have the allegations that's true, but even if it was, Mr. Fastow is responsible for the decisions he made. And there is no way that if these allegations are as they're described, if what happened is what's in this document, there is no way he did not understand the magnitude and the reality of what he was doing.
He made Enron look like a Wall Street winner until it most definitely wasn't, and everybody lost. Kurt Eichenwald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kurt Eichenwald is senior writer for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Dallas, Texas. In a classic New Yorker cartoon, two businessmen, a spectacled grandfatherly type and a brash-looking 30-something, are seated across the desk from one another, and the caption below reads, "I'll have someone from my generation get in touch with someone from your generation." Behind the humor lies the gap in American generations and American leaders, those from the old school and those from the new. Their experiences could hardly be more different, but the old will give way, is giving way, to the new with all that that implies. Robert Thomas and Warren Bennis set out to find how era and generational values shape those who lead. They looked at leaders under 35 and over 70 years of age to find their motivations, their dreams, what made them tick. The findings are in their new book, Geeks and Geezers. What does the passing of the torch from one generation of leaders to another mean for American business, politics, and America's place in the world? Are you confident of the character and abilities of a new generation of leaders? Are you skeptical or eager to bring them on? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Robert Thomas, co-author of Geeks and Geezers, How Era, Values, and Defining Moments Shape Leaders. He's a senior fellow with the Accenture Institute for Strategic Change in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Robert Thomas.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. So you've got a big theory, you're putting it out there, and you look at these two generations, one over 70, the other under 35. So we acknowledge these generations are not back-to-back. There's a gap in the middle. Nevertheless, over the next decade, one will be pretty well off the national stage, if it's not already, and the other will be moving right into the heart of its leadership years. How significant a generational shift, then, are we about to enter?
Oh, I think it's a pretty dramatic shift. The key, I think, though, to think about here is that you've got a group of people who are not anxious to leave the scene. Many of the geezers whom we interviewed, men and women over the age of 70, are still extremely active in business and politics and the like. And so in some respects, they're part of a generation for whom the age 65 or 70 is not the automatic signal it's time to leave. You've got a group of young people, particularly the group that we interviewed, the ones under 35, who already have demonstrated pretty substantial leadership capabilities, who are anxious to take hold. And the biggest difference, I suspect, that we could talk about that we found very early on between the two generations was really around the issue of stability or lack thereof.
Stability, emotional stability, financial stability? What kind of stability?
Well, what's interesting is that the geezers who grew up in the shadow of the Depression and World War II experienced extraordinary instability in their lives. And so when they were 25 to 30 years old, as they told us, their big concern was about making a living, establishing themselves, building a family and a foundation. They had aspirations for the future, but the first thing, the most important thing from their perspective was building a solid foundation. And that certainly was the advice that they were given by their parents. By contrast,
dig in, find your way, lay down the foundation of your career.
Okay, lay down the foundation of your career over and over again. We heard from people like Mike Wallace from CBS News, who talking about his granddaughter saying, look, honey, you've got to pay your dues.
Put in your time, get on the escalator, wait. But they were not without ambition.
Oh, my gosh, no. They had tremendous ambition. In fact, people like Wallace or John Wooden, who was the UCLA basketball coach for so many years, or Sidney Harmon, who founded Harmon Kardon, Mickey Siebert, who founded Siebert Financial, all had a very strong sense of who they were and what they could be. But each one of them, in their own way, had to establish for themselves a foundation. By contrast, the geeks were heard from over and over again saying, look, you know, I came from a period of stability, of everything pretty much being set for me, including career opportunities set for them. But I want to change the world. I want to shake things up.
Now, before we get to that, you say geeks, but you don't necessarily mean technical people.
No, but in a sense, they are technical by virtue of the fact that they grew up knowing computers.
They are the internet, the computer generation. They're under 35. And they were not looking to build a foundation? They're looking for something else?
No, as a matter of fact, so many of them told us that they had the skills, the tools, the ambitions to change the world. Now, you know, for some, at the age of 25, that's a natural statement. I want to make a difference. I want to change the world. But so many of them felt like that they were equipped to be able to do that. Wendy Kopp, for example, who started Teach for America, that began as a senior thesis project. And she said to herself, gee, it's such a simple thing. Why shouldn't we be able to do it?
Is this cockiness or is this credible?
Well, it's a combination. Obviously, at age 25, many of us are very cocky. It's a life stage in which we think we know how things work and how to change the world. But at the same time, if you look at the curriculum vitae, if you will, of this group of young people who we included in the book, they'd already accomplished extraordinary things. So at some level, they not only knew a lot about the world by virtue of TV and the internet, but they also knew how to be able to organize in that world.
But much less patient, not so interested in that putting down that stable foundation. Robert Thomas, what does this portend for American politics, for American business, American life?
Well, the one thing that's very critical, I think we have to make clear here, is that these interviews were done before 9/11. So at some level, as we talk to our geeks, the only crucible or truly challenging events that they'd encountered in their lives had been, for a few, the loss of a business or perhaps the loss of a loved one, but certainly nothing as dislodging or as disrupting as World War II or the Depression. So in many respects, the kind of national, world, historical, formative events that had been experienced by the geezers, they had not been through yet.
But are their feet clambering up the ladder here big enough to fill the shoes of those walking off stage?
In some cases, yes. But I think in many cases, we're talking about people for whom the idea of failure is only a recent phenomenon. In fact, one of the people who we interviewed, Bill Porter, who was the founder of E-Trade, age 72, now is still in the business of building new businesses with the International Stock Exchange. But his concern was about young people. Look, they've never been tested. They've never had the experience of failure. In fact, when he talked about his own grandchildren, he was quite concerned. I spoke to him 6 months after I interviewed him at that point and said, well, in the interim, we've had a fallout in the stock market. A lot of these internet companies have gone to ruin. What do you think? Are you still as pessimistic as you were? And Porter said, no, Matt, as a matter of fact, I'm now a great deal more optimistic.
Post 9/11, a collective challenge to the younger end of this leadership spectrum. And one of the geezers, as you described them, is more confident. We're talking tonight about a generational handoff of leadership in America. Are we in the midst of a significant transfer of power between generations of American leaders? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a generational handoff of leadership in America. We're headed into a new century, and one way or another, there will be a new generation in charge. Our guest tonight is Robert Thomas. He's co-author with Warren Bennis of Geeks and Geezers, How Era, Values, and Defining Moments Shape Leaders. You can join the conversation as well. Who do you trust more, America's gray generation of leaders, or the young upstarts, those born in the industrial era or the computer age? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Thomas, I know that your co-author Warren Bennis has written dozens of books on leadership and very often speaking to the business world. I know that you speak to that very often as well, but tonight we want to look beyond that, because the stakes on the table go so far beyond American business that we don't want to ignore that, because clearly there's some leadership issues there. We heard at the top of the hour about the mess at Enron. What does it mean for a country facing the kind of challenges America will face in this coming century to have a generation of leaders, as you define them, at the young end, under 35, who to this point have not really faced much apart from peace and plenty, and as of 9/11, one big shock, and maybe now a war with Iraq? Can you have the same gravitas, the same weight, the same steadiness at the helm in this generation that you had in a generation that went through depression, world war, or not? Or, on the other hand, is it possible that we'll have leaders who are more open to opportunity and change because they haven't been burdened with those grinding experiences?
Well, those are very good questions. Let me take up the first issue about the experience itself. Probably a most important, as we see post 9/11, is the rise, in a sense, of a desire to give back to the community, to participate in the life of the community, particularly on the part of young people. I mean, both Warren and I have had the opportunity to speak on college campuses to young audiences, not only to gauge their sense of did we get their views right, but also what are they worried and thinking about now. And the one echoing phrase I heard over and over again is, how do I give back to the community? So in some respects, by no means would I want to suggest or encourage the experience of war as a way in which to bring a generation together or to cement its dedication to the community and to society. But it is the case that young people are looking for a way in which they can express their commitment to society.
Well, we hope so, but doesn't that to some degree remain to be seen? I mean, 9/11 is not that long ago.
Exactly.
The proof is not fully in the pudding yet. I guess my question on that point is, we know, because history is pretty well settled now, what the Great Depression was about, what World War II was about. I think we're still sorting through what the dot-com boom and bust, that is, the youth of most of the what you call geeks, the young leaders, was. It seemed to me, in looking at the book, that a lot of your characterization of this generation is rooted in that era of quick money, of big dreams, of paradigm shifts, and all the language and expectations that came from that boom. It was followed by bust. What does that mean to be born in that kind of halcyon moment that gives way to something like dust?
Well, there's an undercurrent in all of the interviews that we do with the young people that, in some cases, people felt like they really wanted to work themselves to the bone in order to be able to make enough money so that they could do what they really wanted to do. Now, in that respect, their attitude toward work is probably no different from anyone else's, and that is, it's not their life. It's a means to other ends.
But it's a very different kind of framing from the older generation you described earlier, who pretty much counted on getting in the harness and working its way steadily through a process of a career not to, you know, earn $100 million in cash out at age 27.
Right. But what would they do post cashing out? I mean, that's over and over again the question we asked. And the things we heard from people were things like, you know, engage in teaching. They'd love to go back and teach in high school. Others talked about creating community health clinics so that they could address the needs of a very specific community. Some talked about using their skills to be able to encourage growth of investment funds in African-American communities. So it wasn't as if somehow I'm going to cash in and go off to Tahiti and live the rest of my life in a hedonistic way. Many, if not all of them, talked about, hey, this is an opportunity for me to be able to give back in a big way.
Does this younger generation have the heft of shoulder to take on the burdens of the world? They can get pretty heavy sometimes.
Well, I don't know that I'd say that they do yet, but at the same time, one of the things that Warren and I did arrive at as a conclusion is something that I certainly didn't anticipate arriving at as a conclusion, is the importance of community service, the importance of how it is that we as a society both shape the opportunities for people to learn to lead as well as create opportunities for people to give back something to society. In fact, one of the things we end up concluding is an argument for universal national service, not necessarily military service, but universal national service, in part because people talk about wanting to have the experience of pulling together to produce something good for society and not having it.
You know, I want to believe that, and I guess there is good evidence that that may be exactly true. On the other hand, I've stood, for example, on the beach at Iwo Jima with American veterans of World War II who came back there for the 40th anniversary. They were committed to a communal good in a much more desperate and all engrossing way than, you know, toe dipping in Teach for America, as worthy as that may be. You talk a lot about crucibles in this book, and I wonder collectively, if a generation has to go deep into a crucible of depression, of war, to have the stuff to lead, or does that somehow actually create scar tissue that blinds it to opportunities that a generation with a bit lighter crucible might see?
Well, let me put it this way. I think that the notion of a collective crucible probably can only be achieved in this kind of catastrophic circumstances that you're describing of war or national economic depression. And certainly, again, that's not something that one would want to wish on anyone. There was a lot of scar tissue that was created by both the Depression and World War II. So not everyone emerged out of it with either a picture of themselves as a leader or better equipped to lead. At the same time, if you talk to the young people as we did, come to discover that many of them have experienced their own personal crucibles. Now, again, it's not a national collective crucible.
Give us some examples.
Well, like someone being responsible for a chemical plant and having someone die on the job and not knowing whether or not it's his fault, their fault, the company's fault, but having to deal with the reality of someone who he was responsible for losing their life and their family losing a loved one and a source of support. Mm-hmm. The loss of a parent at an early age. The case of Michael Klein, for example, someone who by the age 19 was a multimillionaire, losing it all in the real estate bust in Southern California and having to take responsibility for the fact that it wasn't just him losing it and his Malibu condo and his BMW, but all the people who worked for him also losing significant amounts of money. In fact, John Gardner, who we interviewed, who was former HEW secretary under Lyndon Johnson, who was a captain in the Marines, told us, he said he wasn't sure what was more difficult, leading a group of men into battle or having to say to 300 people that they'd lost their jobs.
He wasn't sure. Wow. And you described Mike Wallace, you mentioned him earlier, losing a child at a young age and taking stock out of that, losing a
19-year-old son.
Mm-hmm. And saying, I guess it's time to kick it into gear and really go for my goals, whatever they are.
Right. And at that point in time, Mike Wallace was someone who was, by his standards, quite successful. But he hadn't accomplished what he felt he was capable of.
Nothing like the national figure he became. We're talking with Robert Thomas tonight about a generational handoff of leadership in America. His new book is Geeks and Geezers, How Era, Values, and Defining Moments Shape Leaders. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steele is on the line from Burlington, Wisconsin. Hi, Steele. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot for just generational thing, the older generation,
mm-hmm.
the military stuff, you know, they had stuff like the Reds against us, you know, communists and
Cold War.
And today's generation, they have to worry about loss of wetlands, overuse of land that becomes, you know, saline And
no small thing.
You know, just and I think those are much bigger warriors than you know who you're going to fight tomorrow because you feel your ideology is better than theirs. You know, and I just think you know it's just a lot scarier. You know, we're worried about you know planet maybe warming up. Well, maybe it isn't. And you know international trade and you know all the work's going to someone that makes you know $500 a year. You know, well. Pretty soon, that big level is going to level out, and you know our 100,000 might be worth 500 too. And
still, we get the picture. You're saying it may not be immortalized in history books yet, but there are enormous challenges facing exactly this younger generation. And Robert Thomas, in many ways, if you look at it in ecological terms, staring them straight in the face. This is not a distant issue, but a very current issue. Do you see people? Stepping up with the kind of revolutionary fervor that was in the air in the 90s and applying it to that kind of big, broad agenda, Steele raises?
Yeah, Steele raises a very good point because, in fact, the world is getting smaller in so many ways, not the least of which being the finite resources. One of our young people, Tara Church, at the age of 8 years old, came to the crashing realization, which I, in some respects, it's mind-boggling to me that an 8-year-old would be able to both fathom it and deal with it, that the world was a finite place. It was a drought going on in Los Angeles at the time, and her brownie troop decided to take a weekend trip and realized that there wasn't going to be an adequate amount of water available for them to be able to wash their pots and pans. So they took along paper plates. But in the course of cleaning up the paper plates, somebody said, well, where do these paper plates come from? They come from trees. And at that moment in time, she described to us in detail the kind of sense of sudden closed-in nature of the world, where on the one hand there wasn't enough water, on the other hand there wasn't enough trees, and yet they were consuming both resources with abandon. And at that point, with her friends, her group of friends, started an organization called Tree Musketeers, in which they dedicated themselves to planting trees. And just recently, they planted their millionth tree.
So it's not war, it's not depression, but it may just be an insight unique to the new generation that the older generation never really had to glom onto. You've spent a lot of time pickling in this and thinking about it. I mean, push your mind out there for us, Robert Thomas. What might this young generation lead America to that their elders did not? What kind of direction is this younger generation carved for, shaped for, that the seniors, for all that they have done, simply couldn't imagine or see?
Well, I think probably the biggest difference, then the difference, biggest possibility, has to do with a very simple word, and that has to do with networks. The ability to be able to mobilize people across all the conceivable divides, age, race, gender, national boundary, geography, and the like, to be able to accomplish things that their parents and their grandparents never could have thought of. You know, one of the points that came up over and over again in the course of the interviews really speaks to the story at the top of the hour with Fastow talking about how so many leaders who end up doing things that are either illegal or unethical or at least curious in hindsight do so because they're not connected with others around the world or in their own personal worlds who could either, one, give them advice or, two, provide them with an alternative way in which to look at the problem that they're facing.
So are you saying then the internet is a kind of a template for human relationships, that the networked world is bleeding over into social relationships, potentially political relationships?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's also by virtue of the fact that many of the role models that our geezers had used when they were young, the Lone Ranger, John Wayne, all the notions of the iconoclastic individual who cuts his own path are beginning to erode. And in fact, so many of the young people we've talked to have said that they work in an entirely different way. They work in networks. They work in horizontal organizations. They work in ways that cut across the boundaries that existed and were taken for granted by so many of their elders because they want to be able to get things done as quickly and as effectively as possible. The internet certainly provides them with the infrastructure, the tools with which to be able to do that, but they're much more likely to reach out and grab somebody and build something together than to assume in an Ayn Rand fashion that they have to do it by themselves.
Well, there's a model, and we'll see how it lasts as they step into bigger and bigger leadership roles. Joe's calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to say hello to Bob. Bob might remember me from a long time ago at Arthur D. Little in a carbon black plant in Louisiana. I'll start with that, so he'll remember who it is.
Okay, we've got you located.
Yeah, okay. My question was, you've been talking about leadership from the point of view of politics and where people are headed in community service and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But with situations like we've heard at the top of the hour with Andrew Fastow and with the ethics of some of the companies that we've seen, and frankly the way the economy has reacted to the recent situations like September 11th and the recession,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. How is the youth of tomorrow being able to be prepared? You know, in the past, the leadership was built, the skills were developed because of crisis. And is the youth of tomorrow prepared as they were in the past?
Joe, we'll take the question. And it's not such a distant tomorrow. We're talking people who are as old as 35 already. They're stepping right into these roles. But what about it, Robert Thomas? We've seen, and here's the kind of the generation in between. The boomers and the young end of the boomers who are right at the heart with Andrew Fastow and others of the Enron problem, of WorldCom, of a bunch of these. Do you see a different ethic, a stronger sense of ethics in the generation behind them that's going to clean up this mess? Are they equipped to do it? Or are they part of the pixie dust that made this whole debacle possible?
Well, hi, Joe. And I'm somewhat concerned that I don't want to try and characterize an entire population on the basis of the fact that they grew up in the same moment in time together,
mm-hmm.
because they are going to be different from one another. But I think there is something to the fact that there is a generation now in its 40s and 50s which has the reins of power and which is going to be reluctant to let go of those reins of power, that learned not only a different way to manage but a different way in which to run businesses than their predecessors did. They learned with technical skills that, as I'm reminded by chief financial officers that I meet over and over again, that most CEOs don't have. So you have situations like Andrew Fastow and others who have skills and competencies in being able to manipulate a spreadsheet that many CEOs, many chairs of the board don't have. So they are in a position to be able to snow the older generation. The younger ones behind them are seeing the byproducts of that. And frankly, they may not collectively have a stronger sense of values, but certainly the young leaders whom we interviewed, who we think have the potential to be true, effective leaders over the course of their lives, do have a very strong set of values. It's not necessarily from religion. It's not necessarily from a strong educational background. It's not even necessarily from families or intact families, because at least half of our geeks come from families of divorce.
A big difference, I suppose, from the older generation.
You know, about 10 times more likely to come from a family of divorce than the geezers did. Yet at the same time, we find a strong sense of, certainly amongst the leaders we interviewed, a strong set of values, a strong moral compass. It may come from religion. It may come from Taekwondo. It may come from any of a number of different places. But what distinguishes them, by contrast to many of the people I found in between, is that they do find things that they value highly, and they're not afraid to talk about them.
And do you see then a higher sense of moral values, of ethics in this generation than the boomer generation?
Well, I hesitate to say yes, although I have to admit, you know, our focus in the book was on the older and the younger, and we left aside those in between, in part because we wanted to be able to maximize the contrast between the two
mm-hmm.
age groups.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to say whether they're more or less ethical, but it is the case clearly that the young people whom we interviewed, who by an early age had already accomplished a substantial amount, did have almost uniformly a strong set of values.
Well, there's something to hang some hope on. We're talking tonight about a generational handoff of leadership in America. Our guest is Robert Thomas, co-author of Geeks and Geezers, How Era, Values, and Defining Moments Shape Leaders. What do we lose as the older generation passes from the stage? And what might we gain as a younger generation of leaders steps up? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a generational handoff of leadership in America. Geeks and Geezers, in the words of my guest tonight, co-author of a book by the same name, Robert Thomas, co-author with Warren Bennis, of Geeks and Geezers, How Era, Values, and Defining Moments Shape Leaders. And the question for you listeners is, have the values that made America a 20th century powerhouse been passed down to 21st century leaders? Do you hope they are, or do you hope they're not? And after Enron and the dot-com bust, do you trust the instincts of the country's new generation of leaders? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Greg is on the line. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm an early 30s working professional, and I'm somewhat politically active myself.
Okay.
And I was inspired to call when you asked, you know, do you think that this generation, my generation, you know, can take power? And or, you know, really should take power. And I just thought to myself instantly, no.
Why? We want to hear you say yes, Greg. Why not?
Well, I actually have low faith in people in my generation. I mean, I meet what I consider the exceptions. I meet people who actually seem to have, you know, a strong moral compass and have a strong interest. But
mm-hmm.
I find that many people my age do not keep up with current events, do not participate in community events, are not politically active, do not politically care. That they're much more interested in making money and staring at their own navels.
But we heard Robert Thomas say that he's finding in this under 35 generation a strong sense of values, a strong sense of almost revolutionary possibilities in the world, a sense of collaborative work in business and perhaps in politics. Are you not seeing that, Greg?
Well, I spent a good chunk of the 90s wandering around from dot-com company to dot-com company. So perhaps I'm just a little bit on the biased side because I saw a lot of people who were interested in making money and little else.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I did see a lot of people my own age, and they were much more concerned about picking a hot stock and believing in their own ability as a business manager. And I actually saw a number of people fail as business managers. You know, the only reason they had that position was because there were so many companies around in need of some kind of management talent that, you know, they would give it to just about anyone who was willing to try.
Yeah, Greg, hold on. Let's put it to Robert Thomas. So here's a counter view, a voice from that generation saying, hey, I see self-absorption and an eye on the big prize, but not necessarily the kind of community-mindedness that makes real leadership.
Well, keep in mind that the people we selected for the purposes of this book were themselves already accomplished leaders. So in that respect, they had put their stake in the ground about what they wanted to do with their lives. So.
Well, but we don't want to let you go with that, Robert Thomas. Do you have a sense that they were representative, that the number of folks willing to stand up and take leadership roles is equivalent in this younger generation to what it was in the older generation?
Yes, by every stretch, I think that's the case. And I don't think that there's any lack of interest on the part of people to take the reins of leadership when they're given the opportunity.
So what about Greg's critique?
Well, I mean, look, in every community, there are going to be people for whom achieving financial success is the only goal, and living a life that they're happy with is the only goal. And so, in that respect, you know, we're sampling from two different pools, but they occupy the same space and time.
Greg, do you buy that? Do you smell that out there, even if it's not right at your elbow, are leaders that will take the country positively ahead in your age cohort?
Well, I certainly hope that he's more right than I am. I mean, my instinct is not there, but that's just based on the people that I've met in my travels so far. Although I do have a follow-up question, which would be that if there are so many people in my generation who are willing and able to take power, I wonder if the older generation is actually so willing to cede it. I mean, we have a lot of people who are quite capable and able as they're getting older.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm reminded of our Puritan forefathers who they had older lives and weren't able to pass the farms down to their first sons, and so that's why so many people started to move out elsewhere so that they could start to finally form their own way because they just weren't able to, you know, take over.
Right, and the elsewheres are fewer and farther between. Greg, thanks for the call and the question. What about this whole issue of greater longevity, of people working longer lives? Does it mean that whatever leadership qualities are in this younger generation, they're going to sit there like Prince Charles waiting for the Queen to pass on?
No, as a matter of fact, it gives me a great deal of hope because I suspect what they're going to end up doing is a great deal of inventing, a great deal of innovation, a great deal of testing of the boundaries of what we think is possible, whether it's in politics or in business. They're not going to sit around waiting for their chance. I mean, Prince Charles did a lot of creative things while he waited. I don't think these people are going to do those kinds of creative things off by themselves. They're going to go out and start new businesses. They're going to start new social movements and the like.
Mm-hmm. Greg, thanks for your call. David's on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to, I haven't read your guest book, obviously, mm-hmm. and he may well do this effectively, but I wanted to put in a vote to be sure that we view both generations as accurately as possible.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a member of the older generation you're talking about and did many great things, served in World War II and served in government. But it's also, you know, the generation that gave us McCarthyism, gave us McNamara. We now know, apparently aware, that Vietnam War was unwinnable, but telling the president mm-hmm. to send more troops and that kind of thing. And just as my generation will certainly make mistakes and do great things.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah, and so I'm just a little weary of this contrast of a tested generation of broad shoulders that did great things and a bunch of younger bumpkins or something.
Well, exactly. We've been asking for that kind of view here tonight, whether there may be something in this generation, the new one, that was missing in the old, whether it may fill in where the old fell short. What about that, Robert Thomas? We don't want to turn history into hagiography here. There were certainly plenty of things wrong with the era led by what, you know, the pop marketers called the greatest generation.
Well, I think it's a very good point. And in the course of the book, one of the issues that we take up is this whole issue of the man in the gray flannel suit, the era of McCarthyism, the whole notion of the organization man. I mean, if you think about it, you know, William H. White's notion of an organization man was the person who, like Sloan said, was the master and the servant of the large-scale corporation. On the one hand, they did build economic organizations that were truly unprecedented, produced extraordinary wealth, but at the same time, there are extraordinary pressures for conformity, for discrimination, and the like. And so there was not an unmitigated blessing. When it comes to the young people, you know, again, one of the things that I think we find over and over again amongst the young people is not only a hankering to be able to build a better world, but interestingly enough, as the case of Tara Church that I described before pointed out, also extremely aware of the excesses and the abuses and the inequalities that exist in this world. And while that's a mantle that none of them want to take up, it's also something that they can't ignore. The fact is that on a daily basis, they're confronted with poverty, with starvation in Africa, with the absence of adequate education, with women being killed in ritual stonings in Afghanistan and elsewhere. It's all there in the news. And it's not something that they're necessarily going to avoid and run away from. But at the same time, I think that it is a mantle that we find over and over again they want to take up and try and respond to.
I have to say, I'm very heartened by a lot of signs I see in this generation. Let's get one more call in. Bill's calling from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As you've been, it's been a fascinating conversation as you've been talking about this. I've been trying to deduce from it what it is we can sort of bring together and learn from it. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a descriptive study, and you've convinced me that how we behave is what we've experienced and how we make meaning out of it. But in terms of what we pass on to the next crowd, is there something that you have learned from this that would guide education? Certainly, you mentioned networking is important, the fastows that get isolated, that don't have people to talk to.
Bill, our time's running down, but it's a great question. Let me put it to Robert Thomas, and thank you for your call. You point at common characteristics, adaptive capacity, and so on. Lay some of those out for us quickly, if you would, Robert Thomas.
Well, the things that we found that were common amongst our geezers are the people who had led for a lifetime.
And maybe what you'd hope that a younger generation will hang on to also.
Precisely. Where first and foremost, the adaptive capacity, a certain kind of hardiness, an ability to be able to respond positively to adversity. The ability to engage others through shared meaning, to be able to pull together a group rather than simply create a vision and enforce it on
them. To motivate, really.
Exactly. They have their own distinctive voice. They know what they're about. And finally, they demonstrate a tremendous amount of integrity. But to answer your question of what we take away from this, over and over again, what we heard from people was they learned to lead not through formal programs, not through school. They learned it through experience. The most critical experiences from whom they learned the most were experiences of adversity. And so in many respects, what I think our critical takeaway from this is how do we enable people to be able to make the most of the experiences that they have, to prepare them to learn from the difficult kinds of challenges, whether it's intimately personal or it's social or global in nature. How do you continue to learn not only about yourself but about the world as you experience adversity? And that for us is really the biggest takeaway and the thing that we want to focus our attention on in the future.
Plenty of adversity, no doubt, in this century. In a word, our time is short, but did you come away hopeful from your study?
Very hopeful.
Robert Thomas, it's been great to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Thomas is co-author with Warren Bennis of Geeks and Geezers, How Era, Values, and Defining Moments Shape Leaders. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, writer Philip Martin takes us inside his barbershop. This is On Point. The new movie Barbershop opened recently to an unusual mix of admiration and controversy. The film, starring comedian Cedric the Entertainer and rappers Eve and Ice Cube, has provoked laughs but also anger in the African-American community, notably from Jesse Jackson, for jokes targeting Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and Rodney King. Reporter and writer Philip Martin saw the movie, visited his local barbershop, and sent us this diary.
Miami Hurricanes are playing on Saturday night. We're playing Connecticut, so we could probably get tickets.
Yeah. Hello, America. Welcome to the barbershop. This particular shop belongs to a brother named Troy Anthony. It's a snapshot of ethnic diversity, with Portuguese, Hispanic, African-American, and Irish-American clientele waiting to get a buzz, a fade, or a line. And like the movie Barbershop, it is defined by a single tradition, says Troy Anthony.
You can definitely talk about anything and everything. No holds barred in the barbershop.
That's right. Barbershops universally have never been just a place where you got a haircut, no more than cafes in Paris or pubs in Dublin, exist solely for croissants and Guinness. This is the incubator for conversation and rumor, and this is where you get an earshot of the latest going-ons and hear what people are talking about. And what they're talking about is this scene from the movie Barbershop.
There's three things that black people need to tell the truth about.
What?
One, Rodney King should have got it. For driving drunk and being grown in a Hyundai. Two, OJ did it.
OJ did it.
And three, Rosa Parks ain't do nothing but sit her black down.
That scene and another where Cedric the Entertainer vilifies the Reverend Martin Luther King is causing an uproar within civil rights circles around the country. In fact, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, a target of Cedric's outrage, has called on the film's producers to remove the offensive lines from the movie. Now, in all respect to Reverend Jackson, chill. I bristle just like anyone else weaned on the fibers of social protest when I hear someone dismiss Rosa Parks or when black Republicans diss affirmative action. But it was in the barbershop in neighborhoods in Detroit, Los Angeles, and New York that I first learned the art of debate and the notion of give and take. I've heard every type of conversation in barbershops like this one. So, too, has barber Mark Jaradee.
Last week, we had a cat in here who was part of the new Black Panther Party, and he had people riled up. We had about 10 people in here ready to go to war against these police, man. It's like this is one of them safe havens where cats get to just relax and be yourself.
Most things said in black barbershops like this, you would not hear on the Fox News Channel or, for that matter, on CNN. Many of the comments here about America's idols, including cops, George Bush, and Clarence Thomas, could not be repeated on public airwaves. And here you are more likely to find support for a war on Enron executives than a war on Iraq. But this also is the place where neither Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, or even Martin Luther King are always held on pedestals. There are real Cedric the Entertainers out there who see no one or nothing as sacrosanct. And we are all better off with a debate that results from their iconoclastic behavior. And like the characters that take on Cedric in the movie, when iconoclasm comes perilously close to disrespect, the offending party will be rebuked. And there's one other thing that should be mentioned about the movie. For all the talk about the fear of using politically offensive language, it is politically offensive language that sells everything from white conservative talk shows to black and Hispanic hip-hop. And the producers of Barbershop know this as well as anyone else. So when producers George Tillman and Bob Tytel tell us that it was never their intent to upset anyone going to see the film, you might wink right along with them. These lines were designed to offend, and thus to spark the very controversy we're discussing today in barbershops across the nation.
College things will be out that night, boy.
That was reporter and writer Philip Martin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for the